Chapter 20. Winds Rising. Elaine struggled to open the latch on an arm of her chair and darted after them, almost colliding with Nynaeve at the ladder. The ship still rocked, if not as violently as before. Uncertain whether they were sinking, she pushed Nynaeve ahead of her, prodding her to climb faster. On the deck, the crew dashed about, checking the rigging or peering over the side to inspect the hull, shouting about earthquakes. The same shouts were rising from the dockmen, too, but Elaine knew better, despite the tumbled things on the piers and the ships yet pitching at their moorings. She stared toward the stone. The huge fortress was still, except for masses of startled birds swirling about, and that pale banner waving, almost lazily, in an isolated breeze. No sign that anything had ever touched the mountainous mass. That had been Rand, though. She was sure of it. She turned to find Nynaeve looking at her, and for a long moment their eyes met. "A fine pickling if he's damaged the ship," Elaine said finally. "How are we supposed to get to Tanchico if he goes tossing all the ships about?"
"Light, he has to be all right. I can do nothing if he isn't." "He is all right. He is."
Nynaeve touched her arm reassuringly. "No doubt that second letter of yours touched a nerve. Men always overreact when they let their emotions go. It's the price for holding them in the way they do. He may be the dragon reborn, but he must learn, man to woman, that—" "What are they doing here?" They were two men standing amid the bustling sea folk on the deck. One was Tom Merrillin, in his gleeman's cloak, with leather-cased harp and flute on his back and a bundle lying at his feet beside a battered wooden box with a lock. The other was a lean, handsome Tyran in his middle years, a hard, dark man, wearing a flat, conical straw hat and one of those commoner's coats that fit snugly to the waist, then flared like a short skirt. A notched sword-breaker hung at a belt worn over his coat, and he leaned on a pale staff of knobbly jointed wood exactly his own height and no thicker than his thumb. A square-tied parcel dangled by a loop from his shoulder. Elaine knew him. His name was Juelin Sandar. It was obvious the two men were strangers despite standing almost side by side. They held themselves with stiff reticence. Their attentions were directed the same way, though, split between following the sailmistress's progress toward the stern deck and peering at Elaine and Nynaeve, plainly uncertain and masking it behind a brisk show of confidence. Tom grinned and stroked his long white mustaches and nodded every time he looked up at the two of them. Sandar made solemn, self-assured bows. "He is not damaged," Coeen said, climbing the ladder. "I can sail within the hour if it pleases you, well within, if a Tyrian pilot can be found. I will sail without him, if not, though it means never returning to Tyr." She followed their gaze to the two men. "They ask passage, the gleeman to Tanchico, and the thief-catcher to wherever you travel. I cannot refuse them, and yet—" her dark eyes came back to Elaine and Nynaeve. "I will do so if you ask it." Reluctance to break custom battled in her voice with desire to help them, to serve the Coramore. "The thief-catcher is a good man, even considering that he is shore-bound. No offense to you, under the light. The gleeman I do not know, yet a gleeman can enliven a voyage and lighten tired hours." "You know Master Sandar?" Nynaeve said. "Twice he has found those who pilfered from us, and found them quickly. Another shoreman would have taken longer so he might ask more for the work. It is obvious that you know him as well. Do you wish me to refuse passage?" Her reluctance was still there. "Let us see why they are here first," Nynaeve said in a flat voice that did not bode well for either man.
"Perhaps I should do the talking," Elaine suggested, gently but firmly. "That way you can watch to see if they are hiding anything."
She did not say that way Nynaeve's temper would not get the better of her, but the wry smile the other woman gave her said she had heard it anyway. "Very well, Elaine, I will watch them. Perhaps you might study how I keep calm. You know how you are when you become overwrought."
Elaine had to laugh. The two men straightened as she and Nynaeve approached. Around them, the crew bustled, swarming into the rigging, hauling ropes, lashing some things down and unlashing others, to orders relayed from the sailmistress. They moved around the four shore people with barely a glance. Elaine frowned at Tom Marilyn thoughtfully. She was sure she had never seen the Gleeman before his appearance in the stone, yet even then she'd been struck by something familiar about him. Not that that was likely. Gleemen were village performers in the main. Her mother had certainly never had one at the palace in Camelin. The only Gleeman Elaine could remember seeing had been in the villages near her mother's country estates, and this white-haired hawk of a man had surely never been there. She decided to speak to the thief-catcher first. He insisted on that, she remembered. What was a thief-taker elsewhere was a thief-catcher in Tyr, and the distinction seemed important to him. "Master Sandar," she said gravely, "you may not remember us. I am Elaine Trekand, and this is my friend Nynaeve Almira. I understand that you wish to travel to the same destination as we. Might I ask why? The last time we saw you, you had not served us very well." The man did not blink at the suggestion he might not remember them. His eyes flickered across their hands, noting the absence of rings. Those dark eyes noted everything and recorded it indelibly. "I do remember, Mr. Strachan, and well. But if you will forgive me, the last time I served you was in the company of Matt Cawthon, when we pulled you both out of the water before the Silver Pike could get you." Nynaeve harrumphed, but not loudly. It had been a cell, not the water, and the Black Aja, not Silver Pike. Nynaeve, in particular, did not like being reminded that they had needed help that time. Of course, they would not have been in that cell without Juelin Sandar. No, that was not entirely fair. True, but not completely fair. "That is all very well," Elaine said briskly, "but you still haven't said why you want to go to Tanchico." He drew a deep breath and eyed Nynaeve wearily. Elaine was not sure that she liked him being more careful of the other woman than of her.
"I was rousted out of my house, no more than half an hour gone," he said carefully, "by a man you know, I think, a tall, stone-faced man calling himself Lan."
Nynaeve's eyebrows rose slightly.
"He came on behalf of another man you know, a shepherd, I was told. I was given a great quantity of gold and told to accompany you, both of you. I was told that if you do not return safely from this journey, shall we just say it would be better to drown myself than to come back?" Lan was emphatic, and the shepherd no less so in his message. "The sailmistress tells me I cannot have passage unless you agree. I am not without certain skills that can be useful." The staff whirled in his hands, a whistling blur, and was still. His fingers touched the sword-breaker on his hip like a short sword, but unsharpened, its slots meant to catch a blade.
"Men will find ways to get round what you tell them to do," Nynaeve murmured, sounding not unpleased. Elaine only frowned vexedly. Rand had sent him? He must not have read the second letter before he did. Burn him! Why does he leap about so? No time to send another letter, and it would probably only confuse him more if I did, and make me look a bigger fool. Burn him.
"And you, Master Merlin," Nynaeve said. "Did the shepherd send a gleeman after us, too? Or the other man? To keep us amused with your juggling and fire-eating, perhaps?"
Tom had been scrutinizing Sandar closely, but he shifted his attention smoothly and made an elegant bow, only spoiling it with a too elaborate flourish of that patch-covered cloak.
"Not the shepherd, Mistress Almira. A lady of our mutual acquaintance asked me to accompany you. The lady who found you and the shepherd in Emmons Field."
"Why?" Nynaeve said suspiciously.
"I too have useful skills,"
Tom told her with a glance at the thief-catcher.
"Other than juggling, that is. And I have been to Tanchico several times. I know the city well.
I can tell you where to find a good inn, and what districts are dangerous in daylight as well as after dark, and who must be bribed so the civil watch does not take too close an interest in your doings. They are keen on watching outlanders. I can help you with a good many things." That familiarity tickled at Elaine's mind again. Before she realized what she was doing, she reached up and tugged at one of his long white mustaches. He gave a start, and she clapped both hands to her mouth, flushing crimson.
"Forgive me. I seemed to remember doing that before. I mean, I am sorry. Light, why did I do that? He must think me an imbecile."
"I would remember," he said, very stiffly. She hoped he was not affronted. It was hard to tell from his expression. Men could be offended when they should be amused, and amused when they should be offended. If they were going to be traveling together, that was the first time she realized that she had decided they could come.
"Nynaeve," she said.
The other woman understood the unspoken question, of course. She studied the two men thoroughly, then nodded. "They may come. As long as they agree to do as they are told, I'll not have some wool-brained man going his own way and endangering us."
"As you command, Mistress Almira," Sandar said immediately, with a bow. But Tom said,
"A gleeman is a free soul, Nynaeve. But I can promise I will not endanger you. Far from it."
"As you are told," Nynaeve said pointedly. "Your word on it, or you will watch this ship sail from the dock."
"The Atha An Mier do not refuse passage to anyone, Nynaeve."
"Do you think not? Was the thief-taker," Sandar winced, "the only one told he needed our permission? As you are told, Master Merilyn."
Tom tossed his white head like a fractious horse and breathed heavily, but finally he nodded.
"My word on it, Mistress Almira."
"Very well, then," Nynaeve said in a bracing voice. "It is settled. You two find the sail mistress now, and tell her I said to find the pair of you a cubbyhole somewhere if she can, out of our way. Off with you now. Quickly."
Sandar bowed again and left. Tom quivered visibly before joining him, stiff-backed.
"Are you not being too hard on them?" Elaine said as soon as they were out of earshot. "That was not far, with all the hurly-burly on deck."
"We do have to travel together, after all. Smooth words make smooth companions."
"Best to begin as we mean to go on. Elaine, Tom Merilyn knows very well we are not full Aes Sedai."
She lowered her voice and glanced around as she said it. None of the crew was even looking at them, except for the sailmistress, back near the stern deck where she was listening to the tall gleeman and the thief catcher. Men talk, they always do, so Sandar will know it soon enough as well. They'd present no trouble to Aes Sedai, but two accepted? Given half a chance, they would both be doing things they thought for the best, no matter what we said. I do not mean to give them even that half chance.
"Perhaps you are right. Do you think they know why we are going to Tanchico?"
Nynaeve sniffed. "No, or they'd not be so sanguine, I think, and I would rather not tell them until we must."
She gave Elaine a meaningful look. There was no need for her to say she would not have told the sailmistress either, had it been left to her. "Here's a saying for you. Borrow trouble and you repay tenfold."
"You speak as if you don't trust them, Nynaeve." She would have said the other woman was behaving like Moiraine, but Nynaeve would not appreciate the comparison.
"Can we? Julin Sandar betrayed us once before.
Yes, yes, I know no man could have avoided it, but there it is just the same. And Leandrin and the others know his face. We will have to put him in different clothes. Perhaps make him let his hair grow longer. Perhaps a mustache, like that thing infesting the gleeman's face. It might do."
"And Tom Merilyn?" Elaine asked. "I think we can trust him. I don't know why, but I do."
"He admitted being sent by Moiraine," Nynaeve said wearily. "What has he not admitted, though? What did she tell him that he hasn't told us? Is he meant to help us or something else? Moiraine plays her own game so often, I trust her this much more than I do Leandrin." She held her thumb and forefinger half an inch apart.
She will use us, you and me both, use us up if it helps Rand. Or rather, if it helps whatever she has planned for Rand. She would leash him for a lapdog if she could.
Moiraine knows what has to be done, Nynaeve. For once she was reluctant to admit that. What Moiraine knew had to be done might well speed Rand on his way toward Tarmon Gaiden that much faster. On his way toward death, perhaps. Rand balanced against the world. It was silly, foolish, and childish that those scales should tremble so evenly for her. Yet she did not dare make them swing, even in her mind, because she was not sure which way she would send them. "She knows it better than he does," she said, making her voice firm. "Better than we." "Perhaps," Nynaeve sighed, "but I do not have to like it." Ropes were cast off at the bow where triangular sails suddenly broke out, and Wave Dancer heeled away from the dock. More sails appeared, great white squares and triangles. The stern lines were cast off, and the ship curled out into the river in a great arc through the anchored ships awaiting their turn at the docks, a smooth curve that ended heading south, downriver. The sea folk handled their ship as a master horseman would a fine steed. That peculiar spoked wheel worked the rudder somehow, as one of the bare-chested crewmen turned it. A man, Elaine was relieved to see. Sailmistress and windfinder stood to one side of the wheel, Coeen issuing occasional orders, sometimes after a murmured consultation with her sister. Toram watched for a while, with a face that might have been carved from a deck plank, then stalked below. There was a Tyran on the stern deck, a plump, dejected-looking man in a dull yellow coat with puffy gray sleeves, rubbing his hands nervously. He had been hustled aboard just as the gangway was being hauled up, a pilot who was supposed to guide Wave Dancer downriver. According to Tyran law, no ship could pass through the fingers of the dragon without a Tyran pilot aboard. His dejection certainly came from doing nothing, for if he gave any directions, the sea folk paid them no heed. Muttering about seeing what their cabin was like, Nynaeve went downstairs, below. But Elaine was enjoying the breeze across the deck and the feel of starting out. To travel, to see places she had not seen before, was a joy in itself. She had never expected to, not like this. The daughter heir of Andor might make a few state visits, and she would make more once she succeeded to the throne, but they would be bounded about with ceremony and propriety, not like this at all. Barefoot sea folk and a ship headed to sea. The riverbank slid by quite quickly as the sun climbed, an occasional cluster of huddled stone farmhouses and barns, bleak and lonely, appearing and vanishing behind. No villages, though. Tyr would not allow the smallest village on the river between the city and the sea, for even the tiniest might one day become competition for the capital. The High Lords controlled the size of villages and towns throughout the country with a buildings tax that grew heavier the more buildings there were. Elaine was sure they would never have allowed Godan to thrive on the Bay of Remara if not for the supposed necessity of a strong presence overlooking Mayen. In a way, it was a relief to be leaving such foolish people behind, if only she did not have to leave one foolish man behind as well. The number of fishing boats, most small and all surrounded by clouds of hopeful gulls and fisher birds, increased the farther south Wave Dancer went, especially once the vessel entered the maze of waterways called the Fingers of the Dragon. Often the birds overhead and the long poles that held the nets were all that was visible besides plains of reeds and knife grass rippling in the breezes, dotted with low islands where odd twisted trees grew with spidery tangles of roots exposed to the air. Many boats worked right in the reeds, though not with nets. Once Elaine saw some of them close to clear water, men and women dropping hooked lines into the watery growth and pulling up wriggling dark-striped fish as long as a man's arm. The Tyran pilot began to pace anxiously once they were in the delta, with the sun overhead, turning up his nose at an offered bowl of thick, spicy fish stew and bread. Elaine ate hers hungrily, wiping her pottery bowl with the last scrap of bread, though she shared his unease.
Passages broad and narrow ran in every direction. Some ended abruptly in plain sight against a wall of reeds. There was no way to tell which of the others might not vanish just as suddenly around the next bend. Coeen did not slow Wave Dancer regardless, or hesitate at choosing a way. Obviously she knew the channels to take, or the Windfinder did, but the pilot still muttered to himself as if he expected to run aground any moment. It was late afternoon when the river mouth suddenly appeared ahead, and the endless stretch of the Sea of Storms beyond. The sea folk did something with the sails, and the ship shuddered softly to a dead halt. It was only then that Elaine noticed a large rowboat skittering like a many-legged water bug out from an island, where a few forlorn stone buildings stood around the base of a tall, narrow tower, where men stood small at the top, beneath the banner of Tyr, three white crescents on a field of red and gold. The pilot took the purse Coeen proffered without a word and scrambled down a rope ladder to the boat. As soon as he was aboard, the sails were swung about again, and Wave Dancer breasted the first rollers of open sea, rising slightly, slicing through. Sea folk scampered through the rigging, setting more sails as the ship sped south and west, away from the land. When the last thin strip of land dropped below the horizon, the sea folk women doffed their blouses. All of them, even the sail mistress and the Windfinder. Elaine did not know where to look. All those women walking about half-dressed and completely unconcerned by the men all around them. Jewelin Sandar seemed to be having as hard a time as she was, alternating between staring at the women wide-eyed and staring at his feet until he finally all but ran below. Elaine would not let herself be routed that way. She opted for staring over the side at the sea instead. Different customs, she reminded herself. As long as they don't expect me to do the same. The very thought nearly made her laugh hysterically. Somehow the Black Odja was easier to contemplate than that. Different customs. Light. The sky grew purple, with a dull golden sun on the horizon. Scores of dolphins escorted the vessel, rolling and arching alongside, and farther out some sort of sparkling silver-blue fish rose above the surface in schools, gliding on outstretched fins a span across for 50 paces or more before plunging back into the swelling gray-green water. Elaine watched in amazement for a dozen flights before they did not appear again. But the dolphins, great sleek shapes, were wondrous enough, a guard of honor taking Wave Dancer back where he belonged. Those she recognized from descriptions in books. It was said if they found you drowning, they would push you to shore. She was not sure she believed it, but it was a pretty story. She followed them along the side of the ship to the bow, where they frolicked in the bow wave, rolling on their sides to look up at her without losing an inch. She was almost in the narrowest point of the bow before she realized Tom Marilyn was there before her, smiling down at the dolphins a bit sadly, his cloak catching the wind like the cloud of sails above. He had rid himself of his belongings. He did seem familiar. Truly he did. "Are you not happy, Master Marilyn?" He glanced at her sideways.
"Please call me Tom, my lady."
"Tom, then. But not my lady. I am only Mistress Trakand here."
"As you say, Mistress Trakand," he said with a hint of a smile.
"How can you look at these dolphins and be unhappy, Tom?"
"They are free," he murmured, in such a tone that she was not sure he was answering her. "They have no decisions to make, no prices to pay, not a worry in the world, except finding fish to eat, and sharks, I suppose. And lionfish, and likely 100 more things I don't know. Perhaps it is not such an enviable life at that."
"Do you envy them?"
He did not answer, but that was the wrong question anyway. She needed to make him smile again. No, laugh. For some reason she was sure if she could make him laugh, she would remember where she had seen him before. She chose another topic, one that should be nearer his heart.
"Do you mean to compose the Epic of Rand, Tom?"
Epics were for bards, not gleemen, but there could be no harm in a little flattery.
"The Epic of the Dragon Reborn. Loyal means to write a book, you know.
Perhaps I will, Mistress Dracond. Perhaps. But neither my composing nor the Ogier's book will make much difference in the long run. Our stories will not survive in the long run. When the next age comes, he grimaced and tugged one of his mustaches. Come to think of it, that may be no more than a year or two off. How is the end of an age marked? It cannot always be a cataclysm on the order of the breaking. But then, if the prophecies are to be believed, this one will be. That is the trouble with prophecy. The original is always in the old tongue and maybe high chant as well. If you don't know what a thing means beforehand, there's no way to puzzle it out. Does it mean what it says, or is it a flowery way of saying something entirely different? You were talking of your epic, she said, trying to guide him back, but he shook his shaggy white head. I was talking of change. My epic, if I compose it, and Loyal's book, will be no more than seed, if we are both lucky. Those who know the truth will die, and their grandchildren's grandchildren will remember something different, and their grandchildren's grandchildren something else again. 2 dozen generations, and you may be the hero of it, not Rand.
Me?
She laughed. Or maybe Matt, or Lan, or even myself. He grinned at her, warming his weathered face. Tom Merrillin. Not a glee man, but what? Who can say? Not eating fire, but breathing it, hurling it about like an Aes Sedai. He flourished his cloak. Tom Merrillin, the mysterious hero, toppling mountains and raising up kings. The grin became a rich belly laugh. Randall Thor may be lucky if the next age remembers his name correctly.
She was right. It was not just a feeling. That face, that mirth-filled laugh, she did remember them. But from where? She had to keep him talking. Does it always happen that way? I do not think anyone doubts, say, that Arthur Hawkwing conquered an empire, the whole world, or near enough.
Hawkwing, young mistress, he made an empire all right, but do you think he did everything the books and stories and epics say he did, the way they say he did it? Killed the 100 best men of an opposing army one by one? The 2 armies just stood there while one of the generals, a king, fought 100 duels?
The books say he did.
There isn't time between sunrise and sunset for one man to fight 100 duels, girl.
She almost stopped him short. Girl? She was daughter heir of Andor, not girl, but he had the bit in his teeth.
And that is only 1,000 years back. Go back further, back to the oldest tales I know from the age before the age of legends. Did Mosk and Merk really fight with spears of fire, and were they even giants? Was Elspeth really queen of the whole world, and was Anla really her sister? Was Anla truly the wise counselor, or was it someone else? As well ask what sort of animal ivory comes from, or what kind of plant grows silk, unless that comes from an animal too.
I do not know about those other questions, Elaine said a bit stiffly, being called girl still rankled. But you could ask the sea folk about ivory and silk.
He laughed again, as she had hoped, though it still did no more than drive home the certainty that she knew him. But instead of calling her foolish, as she half expected and was prepared for, he said, practical and to the point, just like your mother, both feet on the earth and few flights of fancy.
She lifted her chin a little, made her face cooler. She might be passing herself off as simple Mistress Dracond, but this was something else. He was an amiable old man, and she did want to reason out the puzzle of him, but he was a glee man, after all, and he should not speak of a queen in such familiar tones. Oddly, infuriatingly, he appeared amused. Amused!
The Atha'an Mier do not know either, he said. They see no more of the lands beyond the Aiel Waste than a few miles around the handful of harbors where they are permitted to land. Those places are walled high, and the walls guarded so they cannot even climb up to see what is on the other side. If one of their ships makes landfall anywhere else, or any ship not theirs, only the sea folk are allowed to come there. That ship and its crew are never seen again. And that is almost as much as I can tell you after more years of asking than I like to think of. The Atha'an Mier keep their secrets, but I do not believe they know much to keep here. From what I have been able to learn, the Kyrianen were treated the same,
when they still had the right to travel the silk path across the waste. Kyrian and traders never saw anything but one walled town, and those who wandered from it vanished.
Elaine found herself studying him much as she had the dolphins. What kind of man was this? Twice now he might have laughed at her. He had been amused just then, as much as she hated to admit it. But instead he talked to her as seriously as, well, as father to daughter.
You might find a few answers on this ship, Tom. They were bound east until we convinced the sailmistress to take us to Tanchico. To Shara, the cargo master said, east of Mayen. That must mean beyond the waste.
He stared at her for a moment.
Shara, you say? I have never heard any such name before. Is Shara a city or nation or both? Perhaps I will learn a little more.
What did I say? She wondered. I said something to make him think.
Light. I told him we convinced Coeen to change her plans.
It could not make any difference, but she scolded herself severely. A careless word to this nice old man might do no harm, but the same might kill her in Tanchico. And Nynaeve, too, not to mention the thief-catcher and Tom himself, if he was such a nice old man.
Tom, why did you come with us? Just because Moiraine asked?
His shoulders shook. She realized he was laughing at himself.
As to that, who can say? Aes Sedai asking favors are not easily resisted. Perhaps it was the prospect of your pleasant company for the voyage. Or perhaps I decided Rand is old enough to look after himself for a while.
He laughed out loud, and she had to laugh with him. The idea of this white-haired old fellow looking after Rand, the feeling that she could trust him came back, stronger than ever, as he looked at her. Not because he could laugh at himself, or not only that. She could not have given a reason beyond the fact that, looking up into those blue eyes, she could not make herself believe this man would ever do anything to harm her. The urge to pull one of his mustaches again was almost overwhelming, but she schooled her hands to stillness. She was not a child, after all. A child. She opened her mouth, and suddenly everything went out of her head.
"Please excuse me, Tom," she said hurriedly. "I must... excuse me."
She started toward the stern quickly, not waiting for a reply. He probably thought the ship's motion had upset her stomach. Wave Dancer was pitching more rapidly, moving faster through the great sea swells as the wind freshened. Two men stood at the wheel on the stern deck, the muscle of both needed to hold the vessel on course. The sailmistress was not on deck, but the windfinder was, standing at the rail beyond the wheelmen, bare to the waist like the men, studying the sky where billowing clouds rolled more fiercely than the ocean. For once it was not Jorin's state of dress, or undress, that bothered Elaine. The glow of a woman embracing Sidar surrounded her, clearly visible despite the lurid light. That was what she had felt, what had drawn her, a woman channeling. Elaine stopped short of the stern deck to study what she was doing. The flows of air and water the windfinder handled were cable-thick, yet her weaving was intricate, almost delicate, and it reached as far as the eye could see across the waters, a web drawn across the sky. The wind rose higher, higher, the wheelmen strained, and Wave Dancer flew through the sea. The weaving stopped, the glow of Sidar vanished, and Jorin slumped at the rail, leaning on her hands. Elaine climbed the ladder quietly, yet the sea folk woman spoke in a soft voice without turning her head as soon as she was near enough to hear.
In the middle as I worked, I thought that you were watching me. I could not stop then. There might have been a storm even Wave Dancer could not survive. The Sea of Storms is well named. It will throw up bad winds enough without my help. I meant not to do this at all, but Coeen said we must go quickly, for you and for the Coramore.
She raised her eyes to peer at the sky.
This wind will hold until morning if it pleases the light.
This is why the sea folk do not carry Aes Sedai, Elaine said, taking a place beside her at the rail. So the tower won't learn windfinders can channel. That is why it was your decision to let us aboard, not your sister's. Jorin, the tower will not try to stop you,
There is no law in the tower to stop any woman channeling, even if she is not Aes Sedai.
Your white tower will interfere. It will try to reach onto our ships, where we are free of the land and landsmen. It will try to tie us to itself, binding us away from the sea. She sighed heavily. The wave that has passed cannot be called back. Elaine wished she could tell her it was not so, but the tower did seek out women and girls who could learn to channel, both to bolster the numbers of Aes Sedai, dwindling now compared to what they once had been, and because of the danger of learning unguided. In truth, a woman who could be taught to touch the true source usually found herself in the tower whatever she wanted, at least until she was trained enough not to kill herself or others by accident. After a moment, Jorin went on.
It is not all of us, only some. We send a few girls to Tar Valon so Aes Sedai will not come looking among us. No ship will carry Aes Sedai whose windfinder can weave the winds. When you first named yourself, I thought you must know me, but you did not speak. You asked passage, and I hoped perhaps you were not Aes Sedai despite your rings. A foolish hope. I could feel the strength of you both, and now the White Tower will know. I cannot promise to keep your secret, but I will do what I can.
The woman deserved more.
Jorin, I swear by the honor of House Trakand of Andor that I will do my best to keep your secret from any who would harm you or your people, and that if I must reveal it to anyone, I will do all in my ability to protect your people from interference. House Trakand is not without influence, even in the tower, and I will make Mother use it, if need be, somehow.
If it pleases the light, Jorin said fatalistically, all will be well. All will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of thing will be well, if it pleases the light.
There was a Damani on that Shanchan ship, wasn't there?
The Windfinder gave her a quizzical look.
One of the captive women who can channel.
You see deeply for one so young. That is why I first thought you might not be Aes Sedai, because you are so young. I have daughters older than you, I think. I did not know she was a captive. That makes me wish we could have saved her. Wave Dancer outran the Shanchan vessel easily at first. We had heard of the Shanchan and their vessels with ribbed sails, that they demanded strange oaths and punished those who would not give them. But then the Damani broke two of his masts, and they boarded him with swords. I managed to start fires on the Shanchan vessel. Weaving fire is difficult for me beyond lighting a lamp, but it pleased the light to make it enough, and Toram led the crew to fight the Shanchan back to their own decks. We cut loose the boarding hooks and their ship drifted away, burning. They were too occupied with trying to save him to bother us as we limped away. I regretted seeing him burn and sink then. He was a fine ship, I think, for heavy seas. Now I regret it because we might have saved the woman, the Damani. Even if she damaged him, perhaps she would not have free. The light illumine her soul and the waters take her peacefully. Telling the story had saddened her. She needed to be distracted. Jorin, why do the Atha'an Mier call ships he? Everyone else I've ever met calls them she. I don't suppose it makes any difference, but why?
The men will give you a different answer, the Windfinder said, smiling. Speaking of strength and grandness and the like as men will, but this is the truth. A ship is alive, and he is like a man, with a true man's heart.
She rubbed the rail fondly, as if stroking something alive, something that could feel her caress.
Treat him well and care for him properly, and he will fight for you against the worst sea. He will fight to keep you alive, even after the sea has long since given him his own death stroke. Neglect him, though, ignore the small warnings he gives of danger, and he will drown you in a flat sea beneath a cloudless sky.
Elaine hoped Rand was not as fickle as that.
Then why does he hop about, glad to see me go one minute, and sending Julin Sandar after me the next?
She told herself to stop thinking about him. He was a long way away. There was nothing to be done about him now. She glanced over her shoulder toward the bow. Tom was gone. She was sure she had found the key to his puzzle, just before she had felt the Windfinder channeling. Something to do with his smile. It was gone, whatever it was.
Well, she meant to find it again before they reached Tanchico if she had to sit on him, but he would still be there in the morning.
Jorin, how long before we reach Tanchico? I have been told rakers are the fastest ships in the world, but how fast?
To Tanchico?
To serve the Koromor, we will not stop at any port between. Perhaps 10 days, if I can weave the winds well enough, if it pleases the light that I find the proper currents. Perhaps as few as 7 or 8, with the grace of the light.
10 days? Elaine gasped. It cannot be possible. She had seen maps, after all. The other woman's smile was half pride, half indulgence.
As you yourself said, the fastest ships in the world. The next quickest take half again as long over any stretch, and most more than twice as long. Coasting craft that hug the shore and anchor in the shallows each night, she sniffed contemptuously, require 10 times as much.
Jorin, would you teach me to do what you were just doing?
The Windfinder stared, her dark eyes wide and shining in the fading light.
Teach you? But you are Aes Sedai.
Jorin, I have never woven a flow half as thick as those you were handling, and the scope of it, I'm astounded, Jorin.
The Windfinder stared a moment more, no longer in amazement, but as if trying to fix Elaine's face in her mind. Finally, she kissed the fingers of her right hand and pressed them to Elaine's lips.
If it pleases the light, we both shall learn.